Hi, thanks. Great to be here. Thank you, Red Wolf. You can all hear me, can't you, without this microphone? Yeah? Okay, great. I want to say a few more words about what he was talking about earlier with what happened tonight with the Homeland Security, which used to be known as Immigration. I don't know, whatever, IMS, whatever. But before I do, I just, what I had in mind to talk about tonight is to give a short overview of what it is to be an economic hitman and sort of a history of the post-World War II world, which really is a history of the building of an empire. And to talk a little bit about what I did in that, and then to kind of throw this open to you. We're a small group, we're intimate, and I think we can all just have a good exchange if we open to that. And so so that's kind of the way I see this evening going. But I was really struck. I was at dinner tonight with a group of people who put this organization together that you see listed up here. And this crisis came up where a man from another country, from Honduras, was here and is being tremendously hassled by our immigration services, by Homeland Security. Is in fact, as I understand it, and we're not sure what all the details are, in prison tonight. And probably being moved from one prison to another so that the lawyers can't get out there to help him. And I think that's rather shocking. And he's an indigenous man from Honduras. Myself, the reason that I was able to have, I think, the courage to come out and talk about what I did as an economic hitman was because of my own experiences with indigenous people. Mine was primarily in the Amazon and the Andes. But there's so much for us to learn from this, and I think Red Wolf, in all due respect, you were a little gentle tonight, and I think we've got to be a little tougher on all of this. I just came from Santa Fe, or a couple of nights ago, I did a talk to as a fundraiser for a NPR radio station. They need a lot of help these days, and we did a fundraiser in an auditorium that seats 800 people. They charged $20 for people to come to this. All the money, I don't get any money from this, it all went to the NPR station. And we had standing room only. We made close to $20,000 that night with book sales also. It's a little different here tonight. And what I would like to do on behalf of Red Wolf and this organization is to ask all of you to really get behind what these people are doing here, and other civil and civic organizations and movements, because that's how we change the world. You know, we really, none of this is about me, I know. And I know that the book is a bestseller now. I feel totally separate from this book. I wrote it once upon a time, but it's taken on a life of its own, and people who read it read a lot into it that I didn't know I was putting into it. They read about themselves and what they're doing on this planet. And so whether there's 10 people in a room, or like in Santa Fe, over 800, it has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do, though, with getting the message out. And so what I want to do is tonight, before we really get started here, is ask you to really give support to this organization and others here. And let's get the people out. Let's get people to come together in groups like this, in bigger groups. And the energy that builds out of all that is going to change the world. And that's what this is all about, changing the world. So I just wanted to make that comment. You all look very serious here tonight. So we'll talk about post-World War II history a little bit. And to me, post-World War II history really began with World War I, the Great Depression, and then went into World War II. And by the end of World War II, as it was winding down, my parents and grandparents and yours were terrified. They'd come through a very, very difficult time in history. We may think this is a difficult time, and it is, but so was theirs. World War I, the Depression, World War II were terrifying times. And they were determined at the end of World War II not to let this happen again. They were determined to take control, in essence. And so, among other things, they went to Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, my home state, and created the Bretton Woods organizations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and other sister organizations that would evolve out of this. Now, I think at the time, this was done innocently. It was done with a real intent, I believe. I was very young at the time, so I can't guarantee this. But I think it was done truly with the intent to rehabilitate and reconstruct a devastated world. However, what I do know, and I'm not sure what happened at the beginning, but what I do know is that as time went on, the new enemy emerged, the Soviet Union. And this was an enemy that was very, very terrifying to us. It had nuclear armaments. Few of you are old enough to remember, as I do, that being in elementary school, and when the sirens went off, we all climbed under our desks to protect ourselves from nuclear fallout. This is funny, folks, you know, like, under your desk to protect yourself from nuclear fallout. You are a serious group tonight. What's going on here? It's really not that serious. It's just about the future of the world. So very soon, the World Bank, the IMF, and the sister organizations really were about convincing the world that capitalism was better than what the Soviet Union had to offer. And a cozy relationship developed between the capitalistic organizations, the corporations, and these Bretton Woods organizations. And this increased over time, so that by the time détente finally came along and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, this cozy relationship was very, very strong and had really gotten out of hand. And what we'd managed to do in this process was to create the world's first truly global empire, which is what we have today. And this empire has a number of unique characteristics. First of all, it's the first truly global empire. There's never been another one before. It's unique in that regard. Second, it's the first empire ever to have been created not by the military, for the most part, but by economics. The military is there in the shadows, it plays a role, but for the most part, this empire has been created by men like me, economic hitmen. And thirdly, it's an empire that has no emperor. There is no king. And despite what some of you Democrats may believe, there's not even a dynasty. What we have instead is something I call the corporatocracy, which are a few men and women who run our biggest corporations and our government and our big international banks. And at the highest levels, they're one and the same person. They're moving back and forth all the time. So that you got somebody who's, you know, CEO of a big oil company for a few years and then becomes Secretary of Defense or something like that, Vice President, who knows, and then finishes that job and goes back into becoming a CEO again of one of the big industries. And this happens under Democratic as well as Republican administrations. So that throughout all these periods, there's one group of men and women who basically run all this, and this is the corporatocracy. And they are the beneficiaries of the system. Now we're all beneficiaries of the system also. Every one of us who lives in the United States, which I presume includes most of the people in this room right now, we have very incredible lifestyles compared to most of the rest of the world and compared to history. We're beneficiaries of this empire, and we're also the slaves of this empire. But these are the three unique qualities of this empire, that it's the first truly global one, created not through the military, but through economics, and without an emperor, but instead with this corporatocracy. It really started to come into focus how this would be built in this very subtle way back in the early 50s. And the first real instance of an economic hitman, or the protege for an economic hitman, happened in the early 50s when Iran democratically elected a fellow named Mohammad Mossadegh as prime minister of Iran. And Mossadegh was held out to the world as being a great example of democracy. He was Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1951. And people looked to this as being the future wave of democracy. But soon after he was elected, Mossadegh decided that having the oil companies, when they drilled for oil in Iran, to take 85% of all the income from oil out of the country was not acceptable, that they needed to give back more to the Iranian people. And so he began to put into place policies which would reflect this. British Petroleum didn't like this very much. They were the main company at that time in Iran. They had a different name then, but they're now British Petroleum. And the British and the Americans, we both decided that we had to get rid of Mossadegh, despite the fact that he was democratically elected. But Iran borders Russia, and so we didn't dare send in the military because we were afraid this could cause a nuclear holocaust. Instead, we sent in one man, Kermit Roosevelt, CIA agent, grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. And Kermit, with a few million dollars, managed to set up coups and demonstrations, and he overthrew this democratically elected president, Mossadegh, and replaced him with the Shah, who was not a particularly nice character, as most of us know. And I personally knew the Shah. I worked for him, which was not one of my proudest moments in life. Not too long after that, about 10 years later, there was a very, very popular president of Iraq whose name was Qasim. And he did the same thing. Apparently, he hadn't learned his lesson from Mossadegh. He decided that the foreign oil companies, primarily British and American, would have to pay the Iraqi people more money for the oil that they were taking out. And so he decided to implement policies similar to what the Shah of Iran had tried to implement previously to that. The CIA went in and hired an assassin, a high school senior, to take out Qasem. And the high school senior was up in the second story of a building and took a good shot at Qasem and missed him, got him in the shoulder. That high school senior was Saddam Hussein. Not a very good shot in those days. After that, the CIA executed a coup which took and they captured Qasem, and they had him publicly executed on Iraqi television. Most of us aren't aware of that. But then they instilled in power Saddam Hussein's cousin, and Saddam became head of security for the country of Iran and eventually its president. What we learned in that process from both of those cases in Iran and Iraq was that there was a much better way to build empire than the old traditional way, that we could do it quietly in a way that most Americans wouldn't even have any idea it was done. I mean, how many people here know the story of what I just told you about Iraq? How many have heard that story before? You're an enlightened group. I think there's six of you that have heard that before. That's a lot in a group this size. Most Americans have no idea that went on. And most Americans have no idea what went on with Mossadegh. It's been very quiet. And we realized that this was an extremely efficient way to build empire. Didn't cost much, didn't risk war. The only problem was that the CIA was directly involved in both cases. Kermit Roosevelt was a card-carrying CIA agent. Had he been discovered, or had those agents in Iraq been discovered, the U.S. government, I don't like to use this word American, because after all, the Hondurans are Americans, and the Salvadorans and the Bolivians are all Americans, but the United Statesians is a little tough. So we people in the United States had discovered a new way to build empire, a cheap way, a safe way to do it, but we didn't want our government implemented. So at that time in the early 60s, after what happened in Iraq, the decision was made to use organizations like the CIA and the NSA to recruit and perhaps train economic hitmen and jackals, the assassins, but that they would not work for the government. So I came along in 1968. I was a senior in Boston University, and I was recruited by the National Security Agency because it happened because of personal contacts I had. And the National Security Agency, the NSA, which sometimes is known as the No Such Agency because it's so secretive, ran me through a series of tests, polygraph tests, lie detector tests, personality tests, and they discovered several things. One was that I potentially would make a good economic hitman, and two, I had some personality flaws which appealed to them. And I describe them in detail in the book, but I can summarize them here as probably the three great drugs of our culture: money, power, and sex. And who among us doesn't have one of those flaws, at least one of them, you know? So after that, the NSA encouraged me to go in the Peace Corps. I was sent to Ecuador, where I worked with indigenous people in the Amazon and the Andes, people who were opposing the oil companies and still are. So I got some very good on-the-job training. And then when I came out, I was hired by the international consulting firm of Charles T. Main in Boston, and was contacted by an amazing woman named Claudine, who knew all about me, had access to my NSA files, and became my teacher and mentor. And from the very start, Claudine told me that I was getting into a dirty business. She explained to me what it would be like to be an economic hitman, and she explained it like this. She said, you know, economic hitmen, our job is to build empire. And there's a lot of different tools we use. But probably the most typical way that we approach this is to identify a third world country that has resources we covet, like oil, and then to arrange a large loan from an organization like the World Bank to that country. The money never leaves the United States, most of it. It just gets transferred from one bank to another, and it goes to pay U.S. corporations like Halliburton, Bechtel, GE, Lockheed Martin, you know the names, to build big infrastructure projects in this third world country, like power plants and industrial parks, that will serve the very rich of that country and won't affect the poor positively in any way. But the country then will be left holding a huge debt. So large a debt that it can't possibly repay it. So at some point in time, the economic hitmen will go back into this country and say, look, you owe us a lot of money. You can't repay your debts. So give us a pound of flesh. Sell our oil companies, your oil, real cheap. Vote with us at the next United Nations vote. Or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world, like Iraq. And she said to me, that's the way you will go about building an empire. And then she gave me every reason for why I might want to do this. She knew my weaknesses and played upon them very well. She also told me, what you're doing is not illegal. In fact, it's supported by all the major business schools in the country, which was true. And Robert McNamara, the president of the World Bank, is very much behind this. In fact, McNamara often patted me on the back at what I was doing, and I ended up teaching and lecturing about this at Harvard and other schools across the country. So what I was doing was not illegal. In fact, it was very much praised. It should be illegal. And in fact, if I were your banker and I went to you and enticed you to accept a loan, knowing full well that you couldn't repay that loan because I wanted to get a favor from you later on, I'd be committing a criminal act. But if I do this on an international basis, I'm not committing a criminal act. We write, the corporatocracy writes the international banking and commerce laws and the trade laws. That's why it's not illegal. So this was really my introduction and my training, and then I went on to do a lot of work in this area. And I'll mention a couple of those projects simply because I think they tell us something about what else is in the system. For example, I was sent to Panama to bring Omar Torrijos, the president of Panama, over to corrupt him. And Torrijos at the time was very much out in the public view. He was insisting that the Panama Canal be turned over to Panamanians. And the whole world was watching to see what would happen in the negotiations with President Carter. But Torrijos also was a very, very nationalistic person, very popular in his country and with many people. He was determined to help his poor. And when I went to Panama, he invited me to a little bungalow, and he said to me, you know, he said, I know the game that you're trying to play here. And I know if I play your game, I, Omar Torrijos, will become very wealthy. But I'm not interested in that. I want to help my poor people. And so he said, you can either play the game my way, or you can get the hell out of Panama. We decided to go ahead and play it his way. We could make some money in the process, and maybe we could win him over. But we were not able to win him over. And what I realized in this process was that Omar Torrijos was in a very, very dangerous situation. Because this system is based on the assumption that the leaders are corruptible. And when a leader is not corruptible, then not only do we not gain access to his country the way we want to, but he may be setting a bad precedent. And Torrijos happened to be being watched by the whole world. I was also at the time working with the president of Ecuador, Jaime Roldós, who was the first democratically elected president of Ecuador after many years of U.S. puppet-controlled dictators. And Roldós specifically had run on a campaign opposing U.S. corporations, opposing the oil companies, saying that Ecuadorians needed to get their fair share. And he won by an overwhelming landslide. As soon as he was elected president, he began implementing policies, as Hydrocarbons Act, which were intended to give Ecuadorians their fair share of the resources that were taken out of the country. We couldn't get Jaime Roldós to change his ways either. And so in 1981, Roldós was assassinated. And 3 months after that, Omar Torrijos was assassinated by the CIA-sanctioned jackals. This is what happens when we economic hitmen fail. We haven't failed very often, to be honest with you. We're good at what we do. And when we do fail, though, the jackals are sent in. And they'll either try to overthrow our government, as they did in April of 2002 with Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, or if they're unsuccessful at that, they'll try to assassinate the president, as they did with Allende and Lumumba and Roldós and Torrijos and many others. When the jackals fail after the economic hitmen have failed, which is very unusual these days, then and only then does the third line of defense come in, the American military. And that's what happened in Iraq. Iraq is really a classic case of everything else failing, and so we went to the last resort. And to understand Iraq, we really have to go back to Saudi Arabia in the early 70s. Some of you may remember, as I do, how OPEC clamped down on the United States, shut off the oil supply because they didn't like our policies in Israel. And we had long lines of cars at the gas stations, and we were afraid we were going to have another depression like 1929. And so the U.S. Treasury Department came to me and a couple of other economic hitmen and said, it's unacceptable to be blackmailed by OPEC. We can never allow this to happen again. Come up with a plan so that it won't happen again. And we knew that Saudi Arabia was the key to any such plan because Saudi Arabia had more oil than anybody else, and the royal house, the House of Saud, was corruptible. And so to make a long story short, and the longer version's in the book, we worked out a deal whereby the House of Saud agreed to send all of its, or most all of its petrodollars, the money it earned from selling oil to the world, back to the United States and invest them in U.S. government securities. The interest from those government securities, which now has totaled over trillions of dollars, would be given to the U.S. Treasury Department to hire American U.S. companies to build Saudi Arabia in the Western image. And in fact, we've done that. We've built huge desalinization plants, petrochemical plants, cities out of the desert. My father-in-law, I've been married for 25 years to my wife, and my father-in-law was chief architect for Bechtel. I know that company very, very well. He was in charge of designing and building the cities that I financed. I didn't know him at the time, though. And the House of Saud would agree to keep the price of oil within limits acceptable to us, and we would agree to keep the House of Saud in power. This agreement has lasted until today. It's still in effect. It's having a problem right now because the House of Saud is having a serious problem, and we're having a pretty serious problem in Iraq, which is not helping the House of Saud much. But it was a very we considered at the time for us economic hitmen, this was a huge success. And so we figured we'd do the same thing in Iraq. And in the 80s, after all, Saddam's our boy. We put him in power. And in the 80s, we gave huge loans to Saddam Hussein, and we also gave him fighter jets, tanks. We built big chemical plants for him, Bechtel built big chemical plants for Saddam Hussein, knowing full well that he would produce mustard gas and other chemical weapons in those plants to use against the Kurds and the Iranians, which he did. At the same time, the economic hitmen were in there trying to bring Saddam around, but they weren't able to do so. And so the jackals were sent in to assassinate him, but they weren't able to do so. Saddam's security system was too good. He had too many look-alike doubles. Now, if you're the president of a country and you've got bodyguards walking around with you with AK-47s, who's the biggest threat in your life, really? Your bodyguards. And in Latin America, it so happens that most of the bodyguards, at least up until today, were trained at the School of the Americas by U.S. military personnel. It's a pretty well-known fact that people of that nature have a great deal of respect for their teachers, their mentors. And most of these bodyguards in those days were making the equivalent of $10,000, $15,000, the ones that were guarding Roldos and Torrijos. And so when we wanted to take out Roldos or Torrijos, and we took them out by blowing up their airplanes in both cases, all you had to do was plant an explosive on the planes. And in the case of Torrijos, who was very clever, it was done in a tape recorder that was handed to him as he got on the plane. All you had to do was send in some of the trainers to talk to the bodyguards. After all, the bodyguards were their servants, basically. And these bodyguards were making $15,000, offered them $200,000, and you took out Torrijos or Roldos. But in the case of Iraq, it was different. The Republican Guard was much more loyal. And there were all these doubles. Now think about this. How would you like to be a bodyguard for Saddam Hussein and you accept the $200,000 from the CIA to take out Saddam and you shoot him and then you discover it's a double? Figure what your life is worth and your family's life is worth. There's many incentives not to take that risk. So we couldn't take out Saddam Hussein. Instead, we took out his military. We sent in the troops in 91 and took out his military. Did we want to take out Saddam? How many people here believe we wanted to take out Saddam Hussein at that time? Well, that's pretty unanimous. No, of course we didn't want to take out Saddam Hussein. He was the kind of leader we like, a strong man who could control his people, and he also was a huge deterrent against the terrible Persians, the Iranians. So we figured that if we took out his military, we'd have him. And in the 1990s, the economic hitmen went back in, figuring this guy's emasculated, he'll come around now. But he didn't. If Saddam had come around, he'd still be prime minister or premier or whatever he was of his country, and we would be building him all the chemical plants and nuclear plants that he wants, and we'd be supplying him with all the armaments that we want, as we did before. But he didn't come around. I don't know why. I think he was crazy. Because you'd have to be crazy not to recognize what was going on. Again, in the 90s, the jackals went in, but once again, they couldn't take him out. So this time, the military had to do it and took him out. So that's the history. There's a few other complicated issues in there, like the fact that Saddam Hussein decided that he might want to go on the euro instead of the U.S. dollar for selling oil, etc. There's some other issues, but those are pretty basic. And I think that gives a pretty good picture of the building of the empire. The economic hitmen do it very successfully most of the time. Few times they fail, the jackals come in. Few times they fail, the military comes in. But everybody in the world knows that the military is there and the jackals are there. Today, we have a situation in Latin America where we've been sent a very, very strong signal. Six Latin American countries representing three-quarters of the population of South America have voted in presidents who ran on platforms opposing U.S. policy, opposing the corporatocracy, opposing the IMF and the World Bank. Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Venezuela, and Ecuador all have presidents, or did until very recently in the case of Ecuador, who ran on those campaigns and won. The OAS, the Organization of American States, for the first time in its history, its 34 member states just elected a socialist, Chilean socialist Secretary General, who was initially at least opposed by Condoleezza Rice in the State Department. Historical event. South America is where it's happening, in my opinion. South America has sent us an incredibly strong message, and we're not listening. Who's talking about it? Where in the press do you read about this that's going on? We need to listen to this, because at the same time, what's going on today in South America is very indicative of what's happening in the world. Every one of those six presidents is under tremendous pressure. You better believe that the economic hitmen and the jackals are in there, whispering in their ears. Hugo Chavez, Gutierrez, Kirchner. The economic hitmen are in there saying, "Hey, I got $200 million here. I got $200 million here for you. And if you don't want it, I got a gun. I got a jackal in the wings." And say, do you remember what happened to Salvador Allende in Chile? Do you remember what happened to Arbenz in Guatemala? Do you remember what happened to Jaime Roldos in Ecuador and Omar Torrijos in Panama? Do you remember what happened to Patrice Lumumba in the Congo and to Mossadegh? Do you remember what happened? Do you remember what happened? Do you remember what happened to Noriega? Noriega is the big one. If you're a president in Ecuador today, you're maybe saying, if they kill me, I'll be a martyr. That's not so bad. But what if they do to me what they did to Noriega? And personally, I didn't like Noriega much. I loved Torrijos, but Noriega was a different kind of person. But think of what that man went through. He stood up to us. He did not allow, he had a lot of bad characteristics, and he was a CIA agent going after the Colombian drug cartels. Shady character. But he insisted on the right of his country to retain control over its canal. And he insisted on the right of his country to negotiate with the Japanese to build a new sea level canal, which Bechtel was totally against, of course. And so we had to take him out. So in 1989, we sent in a huge force that bombed Panama City, killed 2,000 to 3,000 Panamanians, innocent Panamanians, destroyed a large portion, the old portion of the city. I used to hang out there. I love that part of the city. And Noriega was yanked back here and put in an American prison where he still rots today, essentially in solitary confinement. The press can't even get to him. And so if you're a president of Latin America and somebody's whispering in your ear, "Hey, how about the $200 million I got right here in my pocket? Or we could assassinate you, or we could do what we did to Manuel Noriega. And if we do any of those things, who do you think your country is going to produce that's going to come in and do anything different that we can't take care of?" This is what's going on in Latin America today. And some of these presidents are really standing up to us. And so what it comes down to is we in the United States must do something about this. They can't. They are. They're doing everything they possibly can. But they need us to do more. They need us to insist that we make sure that our president uphold what he promised in his inaugural address, that we would defend democracy and liberty around the world. Venezuela. It's a start. It's his promise. This is a democracy, I think. If it isn't, we've got to make it a democracy. And so Venezuela is a democracy. Hugo Chavez, we overthrew him in 2002 and he got back in. And he just got a 70% vote in the last straw poll that was done in his country. He's been voted in president twice. He's very popular. Oh, he's got his enemies. All the rich people hate him. I've got some very good Venezuelan friends living in Miami who hate him. But he's voted in. He's a democracy. He's clamping down on American oil companies. So what? We've got to defend. We, the people of the United States, have to defend his right to set whatever price he wants for his oil and his people want, whatever taxes they demand of our oil companies. If our oil companies don't want to go there, they don't have to. And then he'll have to drop his taxes or whatever. Well, let's bring this up a little bit more to the current time. I'm very, very optimistic. We're going to change this world. We've reached this incredible point in time. Must be a call from the White House. The NSA, you better take it. Wait a minute. If you press that button, it may go off. Nobody wants to admit it's their phone. You know, so everybody is sort of sitting here like... I had a really embarrassing moment. I mean, I'm always chiding people that, like I am now here. And the other day, I do a lot of radio shows these days, talking shows. Go ahead, take it. And just tell him that, you know, tell George you'll get back to him later. And so I'm on. It's okay. I've been there, believe me. Yeah, I know. They turn themselves on. It's amazing. Mine did that on the airplane flying in here today, you know. I nearly got thrown out the exit door as a result. And the other day I'm on this radio program, you know, on the telephone, and my cell phone's sitting on the desk next to me, and it's ringing as I'm on this live radio show. Anyway, so, you know, here we are at this point in history, and we've created this amazing empire. And you can think of it in a way as being like a great octopus that sits in the United States, and its tentacles reach to every remote corner of the planet. And it's sucking all the resources from all those corners of the planet. And so today we've got a situation where less than 5% of the world's population, us, are consuming more than 25% of the world's resources. And we're creating more than 25% of the world's major pollution. Now, I ask you, is that a model that we can take to China, or India, or Africa, or Latin America? Obviously, no. It's a failed model. It doesn't work. We can't even continue doing it here, and we don't want to continue doing it here. None of us is really very happy with that model, including a lot of CEOs that I know that really aren't very happy with what's going on. And we know that empires always collapse. This one, too, will collapse. It cannot continue like this. And so, but we have had successes in that we can now communicate with everybody on the planet. We had this network, these tentacles that reach across the planet have tremendous distribution systems. There's 24,000 people dying every single day from hunger and hunger-related diseases. 24,000 people every single day. Another 30,000, mostly children, die from curable diseases because they don't get the medicines that should be available to them. Over 50,000 people every single day die these miserable, painful, needless deaths. And they're dying these deaths partly as a result of these tentacles that are sucking their countries, their regions dry. But we've created all, we have all the resources today that we need to reverse that flow. We can send out compassion to these people. We could teach people how to produce their own food so the 24,000 don't need to starve to death. We can teach people how to provide their own medicines. We are in that position today where we can do this, where we have the ability to do this. It would be another first in history. All these unique characteristics of this empire, this would be a new one. Because when empires collapse, we create vacuums and wars occur. And usually a new empire arises that probably won't be any better than the current one. And so that doesn't make sense, to just have the empire collapse. What I think we need to do is go from here and create something truly unique, truly first in the world, where we can really reach out to the world and provide to all people around the world what our founding fathers envisioned, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people. Now, my own background in indigenous, when I was in the Peace Corps, I became interested in these indigenous people, which I have been for many years, and I founded a nonprofit organization in 1990 called Dream Change, which you can check out on dreamchange.org. which works with indigenous people in many of the countries that I ripped off beforehand. And in the past 15 or so years of doing this kind of work, and even before then, when I was always visiting indigenous people, I found that all over the world, most indigenous cultures have a prophecy about this time as being a time with the potential for tremendous opportunity for change. And the one that brings most resonance with me, and I think is symbolic of many of the others, is one that came out of the Amazon and the Andes, the Quechua people. There's about 25 million Quechua-speaking people in the world, in Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador. And it moved up through the Mayas and the Hopi and up into this part of the world. It's called The Legend of the Eagle and the Condor. And what it basically says is that sometime, and this legend goes back, nobody knows how far back it goes, but probably back to before the time of Christ, people were talking about this legend. And way back then, they were saying that human beings on this planet would separate into two general categories, two tribes, if you will. One would be the eagle tribe, which is the tribe of the head, the brain, the mind, the rational, the scientific. And the other would be the condor tribe, the tribe of the heart, sensitivity, feelings. And they would go their separate ways. And then during the fifth Pachacuti is a 500-year interval in the Quechua language. During the fifth Pachacuti, which would begin in the 1490s, the two would come together, the peoples of the eagle and the peoples of the condor, and they would clash. And the eagle people would be so strong and brutal that they would practically wipe out the condor people. But then, according to this legend, in the fifth Pachacuti, which would begin 500 years later in the 1990s, the opportunity would arise for the eagle and the condor to come together and soar together, fly in one sky. And what this would mean is that they would create a new level of consciousness, actually evolving into a new species. It would, not physically necessarily, but emotionally, mentally, they would create a whole new level of consciousness where the heart and the mind would come together. And the Mayans have a very similar prophecy that says that in the year 2012, their 17 calendars come together and end, and that only those people who rise to higher levels of consciousness, who actually vibrate at a higher level, will walk this earth after the year 2012. Many, many different cultures, the Buganese people of Indonesia, the Bedouin of the Persian deserts, the Tibetans, the Dalai Lama has a similar legend. And I believe these legends. And when I've spent enough time with indigenous people to have a great respect for their legends and prophecies, and when so many around the world make this prophecy, I have to take it seriously. I think we've truly reached this time. And on 9/11, which was a pivotal moment for many of us, and for me it was, on 9/11 I happened to be in the Amazon with the Shwa people, who I first lived with in 1968 as a Peace Corps volunteer. Has anybody ever seen a shrunken head or a picture of one? Yeah? Well, the Shwa did it. Because they're the only people who shrink heads. There are many headhunters in the world, but they're the only ones who shrink heads. And I lived with them in 68 and been going back ever since. I have family there. And on September 11th, I happened to be with them. I'd taken a group of Dream Change people in to live and work with them and learn from them. But shortly after that, I came back. And incidentally, after that, I was with the Quechua people, with the same group of people, right after 9/11. And what they told us is, oh yes, this is the beginning of the new Pachacuti. This is what 9/11 is all about. Because they said, now, if I'm an eagle and you're a condor, and I've raped and pillaged and murdered and beat up on you for 500 years, and now I suddenly come to you and say, hey, it's the new Pachacuti. Let's all fly together in one sky. Come dance with me. What are you going to say? Well, condors don't say no, typically. What they say is prove it. Prove this to me. And so what we heard from the Shwa and the Quechua right after 9/11 was, this is the test. The condor is asking you to prove yourself. Remember now, 3,000 people died on 9/11, but that same day over 50,000 people died in the condor countries from hunger and hunger-related diseases, incurable diseases. 50,000 versus 3, both tragedies. So what I got the message, what we got the message was, this is the new Pachacuti, and you're being tested. How are you going to respond? What are you going to say? How are you going to show us that you really want to fly with us? Well, shortly after I got back to the United States, I went to Ground Zero. I flew up to New York, and I went down there, and I stood there, and I looked down into this tragic pit that still was smoldering, and I could smell the burning flesh. And I knew at that point that I had to speak the truth. I had to talk about my life as an economic hitman, because I knew I had to take responsibility for what had happened there, and in a way we all do. Because, and I'm not excusing a mass murderer like Osama bin Laden for anything at this point, but what I do know is that Osama bin Laden and what happened at 9/11 reflects a tremendous amount of anger, a tremendous amount of hatred in the world today. We Americans may believe that foreign aid is altruistic, which it isn't, for the most part. People in the third world know it isn't. Even illiterate people who can't read newspapers, they know, they've heard that their country just received billions of dollars in loans, and they see the Bechtel and Halliburton logos over there doing the construction, and they know that these power plants that are being built aren't going to reach their cardboard shacks or their farms out in the campo. They know that they're not going to get any of the benefits, but they also know that their country is going to be saddled with a huge debt, so their government's never going to give them decent education or any education or health care or food or any other social services. They know this. And they also know that 50,000 people are dying every day. They don't know that statistic, but they know their neighbors are. They know their kid just died. Their newborn just died because he didn't have the right nutrition. And they're angry. And so in 2002, the year after 9/11, in the Muslim world, what was the most popular name of newborn young men? Babies. Osama. And you can go to Latin America. I just came back from the World Social Forum in Brazil and see posters of Osama bin Laden that proclaim that he is the new David standing up to Goliath. Now that's a tragedy that we've created. And this is what I realized at 9/11. I had to write this book. I had to stick my head in a noose. And America needs to know, because I really believe that once we know in the United States what we're doing, we will demand change. And when we demand change, we will get it. It's happened time and time again. You women couldn't vote in this country 100 years ago. Well, today you can go into the polling booths anyway. The blacks couldn't ride on the same bus as whites 30 years ago. The eagle was practically extinct. Rivers throughout this country were on fire 30 years ago because they were so polluted. You know, those things have all changed because we demanded change. The Soviet Union was a huge threat to all of us 20 years ago. We thought it was. Today it doesn't even exist. And it was not destroyed by the CIA or the US military. It was brought down because of a change of consciousness, because a few union leaders, playwrights and poets and environmentalists, changed the consciousness of a whole people. Consciousness, changing consciousness, is where it all comes from. And that's what the legend of the condor and the eagle is all about. And I'm totally convinced, and I was as I stood there at 9/11, that we must understand what we're doing in the world. And when we understand that, we will demand change and we will get it. I have a 23-year-old daughter, and I knew for her sake and for her brothers and sisters around the world that I had to tell this story. And I have tremendous hope, because we have all the resources we need to create something that has never been created on this planet, something that truly reflects what this country stands for. So I mentioned some unique characteristics about this empire. There's a couple of others. This empire is founded on an amazing belief system, and its sacred documents, the Declaration and the Constitution, come from the philosophies of people all over the world. the ideas behind the Declaration of Independence that Thomas Jefferson and others put together came from Asia and Europe and Africa and Polynesia. And the very system that they organized, our governmental system, the model for that was our own indigenous people and some of those of Latin America. And so our most sacred documents are truly global. And our whole system of government is global. And that revolution in the 1700s was an amazing experience that impacted the whole world. Every one of those people that participated in that revolution, every one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine and George Washington, and all the children and all the women who poured lead to make the bullets and who created the food to support the armies, every one of those people was a terrorist, a traitor. Every one of them stuck their heads in a noose. Every one of them knew that they could be hanged and would have been, the leaders would have been hanged if they had lost the revolution. But they knew they had to move forward with this. And I think that's a wonderful example for us today. They were up against the most powerful empire in the history of the world at that time, and it was them. It was their own government. And if we think we face difficulties today in changing our government, think of what they were thinking in those days. And so we are at this point in history today. When I was a kid, I grew up in New Hampshire, and I come from about 300 years of Yankee Calvinists in New Hampshire and Vermont, Puritans, and I can date my heritage back to Thomas Paine. He was a distant relative. I also have Abenaki in my background, the indigenous people from New Hampshire and that area. My ancestors, the whites and the blacks killed each other and made love with each other, and you know, it all got mixed together in there. And so I grew up with this amazing appreciation of history and of the history of the American Revolution and the indigenous people, which is, I think, one of the reasons why the experience in Ecuador was so impactful to me, because all my life I had this tremendous respect for the side of my family that went back to the Abenaki. But I was brought up with this great appreciation for what happened in the 1770s, and I always wished that I had been born then, because I thought, those people, really, that was a great time. What a great time to be born. And what I've come to realize now is that this is better. We are in that same time, except we have the opportunity to do something they didn't have the opportunity to do. Really, really reaching out. We are a global community. We are one world. We are we're this tiny spaceship floating around out there, kind of like the Titanic, you know, getting ready to bump into icebergs. But unlike the Titanic, they didn't have enough lifeboats. We haven't got any. So we got to make this work. And we in the United States, whether we like it or not, we are the leaders. People follow us. And we have the resources. We are in a position to do amazing things, each one of us. And we can look at our own history and even our very recent history and see how when we set our minds on creating change, change happens. This area of international relations is an area where we haven't understood the importance of creating change. Unlike, Rachel Carson's came along with the book Silent Spring, and before that very few people realized that DDT was bad for anyone and all these other chemicals. But Rachel Carson's changed the world with one book, just like Thomas Paine changed the world with one document, Common Sense. And there are a few other things going on in both cases. But when we realize the problems we've created and we speak to our neighbors about it, we demand change, and we get it. And so I have incredible hope. I truly believe that we are in this time of the prophecies that indigenous people have shared with us, and that we've come to this point in history when we can really, really create something amazing, something that our children and grandchildren will honor us for, be very proud. Thanks. Thank you.